market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that watched the budget so you didn't have to. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me is Andrew Page, the co-founder, managing director, CEO, chief cook and bottle washer of strawman.com. Which leads me to the question, Andrew. Well, firstly, g'day. What's Strawman?
G'day, Scott. Strawman is a private investment club where people manage play money portfolios to get a bit of experience, but also to signal to other people what they think is worth buying and perhaps why you want to buy it. So if you're after a bit of independent insight from some of Australia's smartest investors, come check us out.
Very good. Andrew has said in previous podcasts, those who aren't listening or haven't listened for a long time, they're going to try and come up with something new every day. So every week. I'm going to ask him and see what I can get him to come up with. We'll see in a couple of months' time how esoteric it gets. Of course, I'm Scott Phillips. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of The Motley Fool. This is Motley Fool Money. Andrew is a former fool, like a great mate of both The Fools and of mine personally, and a smart bloke. And so we figured, hey, let's do a podcast together. We started the podcast together, didn't we? Many, many years ago. You went and did your own thing. Come back to the podcast. Still not back to the fool. Well, maybe one day, maybe. But for now, at least, running strawman.com and doing a wonderful job of it. So, mate, thank you for joining us again this week. This week, budget week. This was a big macro week. And we were talking before we started recording. Macro is both fascinating and difficult, right? Because firstly, it's like the economic machine is really, really important. Because, if it breaks or if we don't run it properly, it can go really badly for a lot of people, and we've seen that. On the other hand, as an investor, you say, well, okay, but what do you want me to do about it? So we're going to try and weave a steady course through both of those topics. You know, bounce from one to the other. We are going to talk about the budget, and we're not going to do it in lots of boring detail, but we're going to kind of summarize some of the key things. And just, again, because if you haven't watched it, didn't read it, the what does it mean thing I think is worth having a chat about. We will talk about, speaking of the budget, iron ore, mate, and the just phenomenal success story there. We'll talk about banks and bank shareholders and buybacks, three Bs kind of, banks and bank shareholders, we'll call it a B, and buybacks. And we will talk about, again, we'll go back to the macro a little bit because we had lots of theoretical conversations about inflation and interest rates, and the proverbial has hit the proverbial this week in a reasonably big way from a stock market perspective this time. So while it's a macro thing, that otherwise feels a bit weird and esoteric, as I said, it kind of gets real when it gets real, and that's when it starts to impact on the economy and on share prices. And let's not hide this one away, potentially higher mortgage repayments. I don't want to scare anybody listening, but that's potentially coming down the pike. All right, mate, let's get on with it. What do you reckon?
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. There was a thing called a budget. It was out on Tuesday night. I've said to you before, I think I probably said to our listeners before, I am one of those rare, thankfully rare people who actually enjoys the budget. And I know that's not...
Nerd.
I know... Thank you. I know that's not... you shouldn't say that in polite company. It's not something you want to actually kind of, say to... I'm going to assume this is a safe space. I'm going to assume that our listeners... care about me enough not to do what you just did and call me a nerd. No, I'm kidding. I'm a massive budget nerd. I'm a massive politics nerd. I'm an economics nerd. That collides beautifully, right? This very place because, look. So I'm not gonna indulge myself too much in this one. But for me, it's kind of like, I mean, I like the economics of it. I like the politics of it. I'm fascinated by both. But it's kind of, to me, it's also, and without being too highfalutin about it, it's kind of the expression of democracy in some ways, right? Like it's kind of like an election, but not quite as cool, where it's literally an elected government saying, hey, here's how we're going to spend your money. And we're going to let you know, and here's all the policies, and you can love us or hate us or do whatever you need to do as a result. And yeah, it's a whole lot of theater, and there was like days and days of leaks, which, is just usual media spin these days. And so there's all that, and it's not perfect, and, pox on both the houses, et cetera, but... I like the idea of the budget. I like the fact it happens. And I did write during the week an example of my questionable affection for the budget. There was a time, mate, where I was working late many years ago and I literally paid to catch a taxi home rather than catching the tram when I was in Melbourne at the time because I was going to miss the beginning of the budget. So whatever that cost me, that was my little economic
that
donation.
Is
to what, isn't that tragic? That is completely, completely tragic.
You got to get out more.
I really, really do. All right. So let's, thank you. Let's move on, I think, to what the budget contained. I'm going to go through a couple. I separate them kind of into good, okay and not great. I won't say good, bad, ugly, but good, okay, and not great. And you may disagree with them, by the way, mate. So I'm just going to quickly do a really quick cook's tour through this. I'm not going to spend too long on it because, you know, it gets boring for everybody. Well, not me, but everybody else. Pretty quickly. if I see you fall asleep, mate, I'll know we need to move on. So what I – here's a couple of things. The extension of the low and middle income tax offset. If you're earning, dear listener, less than 120 grand a year, you are going to have an extension to a tax rebate you got for the last couple of years that was kind of bought in for COVID, I think, or kept for COVID, sorry, bought in to kind of precede some tax cuts that was legislated. It was kept for COVID and then it was supposed to finish on June 30 this year. It is going to continue for at least another year. That's $1,080 or up to that in the back pocket at tax time. $2,160 for a couple, obviously. I love the way they do that. $1,080 for a single and $2,160 for a couple. It's like, yeah, no, I can do the maths, thanks.
But anyway, two.
Exactly. But they did that, so I'll do it. You know, mate, so from an economic perspective, I've said before, I'm a, you know, I don't understand how businesses and some people who want to pay less tax, no one wants to pay more tax, right? But if you want businesses to thrive and the economy to grow, you need more spending. And the people most likely to spend money are those on lower and middle incomes and or welfare recipients who don't have the capacity to save because they're on the, literally the breadline, but you know, they're saving even they get. And so if you're looking for economic stimulus, economic growth, you want to underpin or support the economy post-COVID recovery, this to me feels like a really, really smart thing to do. It's fair for them and it feels like it's good for the economy.
It's good for society, mate. You know, it's one of these things. If there's, you know, if there was ever a more stupid economic theory, it's the trickle-down effect, you know? And so if you're going to give tax cuts, you don't give it to the billionaire who may or may not use that extra thing to buy an ivory scratcher or a super yacht, you know? But when you put it to the other end of the spectrum, that actually, it's good for all of us. It's good for them. Right. It has a whole bunch of societal benefits. And, you know, I don't want to come across as a far right, a far left hippie hurrah or anything like that, but I think there is very, very solid economic evidence for the value of that in terms of just the economy and people. And that's the other point I want to make here is that the economy is society, is people. Right, really, it is a very, very direct line to connect those two things together. So while it sounds all very financy and the rest of it, the economy is just how we all interact with one another and how we choose to structure our society and what we want, you know, as a society. So it sounds a bit airy-fairy, but that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've said the same thing before, mate. The economy is there to serve the society the way around. I will say too, just to stop the hate mail coming to you, when you say trickle down is a terrible theory, it's actually a beautiful theory.
No, I'll stand behind that.
But my point is it's a beautiful theory, it's just not right. So when you say it's a terrible theory, this is not an ideological view. Maybe it is actually for you. I'm not sure. I won't put words in your mouth. But the reality is the evidence suggests that for all of whatever beauty it may have as a concept, it actually just doesn't work. So it's not even like you're saying, you know, kind of ideologically I disagree with it, philosophically I disagree with it. You may, again, both those counts. But the very base reality, the literal dollars and cents of this, is it just doesn't work. So nice theory, doesn't pass the reality test.
Well, this is the hard thing about economics. They call it a soft science. With physics, I can do a double split experiment and shoot electrons through, and I can measure things with a high degree of precision. You know, I can test. Yeah. Economics is hard. We don't have these test tubes, you know, where we can do these very stringent experiments with. Theory, philosophy, / ideology that's sort of out there. Like a lot of these things, there's a great deal of sort of resonance there. It sort of seems to make sense. But after, you know, many, many, many decades of it demonstrably not delivering on its promise, you have to sort of take an evidence-based approach and sort of say, yeah, it sounds good. It wasn't a crazy thing to believe. But, you know, we do have test tubes, not perfect test tubes, but in the sense of different countries and different economies and sort of economy A did it this way and this was the result. Economy B did it this way and that was the result. And the ones that have sort of pursued that trickle-down theory of just seeing a massive increase in the gap between rich and poor and a whole bunch of really bad outcomes. And it just, it doesn't trickle down. Like it just, the evidence isn't there. So I'm a scientist by background, by training. I look for evidence and hey, the evidence ain't there. So I'm pretty happy to sort of stand behind that one and say that it's absolute BS. And I'm sorry if that offends any ideologues out there, but that's
just thank you, half our audience. Thank you, mate.
Sorry.
So look, I think it's a great
prove thing. Me wrong. Was, prove no. me wrong, listeners. I just gotta say, prove me wrong. I'd love to think that I'm very good at changing my mind. So if someone was to sort of say, well, Andrew, what you're forgetting is this, and lay out a really objective, rational case, I'm prepared to change my mind, but I don't see any reason to.
I'm looking forward to you changing your mind on the long-held issues you have with property. We'll talk about that in a minute. My single favourite thing of the budget from an investment perspective, although not for company investment particularly, but for the financial futures, the financial lives, the financial security of every Australian, was the removal of a minimum pay what do you call it? A pay slip, I suppose, minimum dollar value you have to be paid to actually earn super. I have no idea what the rationale for this was. I didn't look into it. But up until now, if you earn less than $450 a month, your employer could say, yeah, no, not giving you super. And I, for the life of me, have no freaking idea why people thought that, yeah, low income earners, let's not pay them super. There's no point. Yeah, and it just boggles my mind. So the good news is in this budget, they've basically scrapped that minimum. And now whether you earn $1 or $1 million a month, well, it's probably different. Whether you earn $1
not everyone earns what you do, Scott.
Right. Exactly. I'm like Linda Evangelista. I don't get out of bed for less than 10 grand. if you're not old enough to understand that reference, go and look it up. But this was just really, like, it was just as stupid that it was even in place in the first place. But now, whether you're a part-time worker, young worker, casual worker, you're in and out of the workforce, whatever, you're now going to get super on every dollar you earn. I just think it's just spectacularly great. Not going to have a huge impact, although if you can earn super from, you know, when you start doing your paper rounds or the old, you know, supermarket checkout chick or sweeping the floor of the hairdressing salon or whatever else you're doing, when you earn money, you get super. And that compound will compound meaningfully over a lifetime. I'm just super excited about that one. I assume you're in the same boat.
Yeah, 100%. Why not? And it's a percentage-based thing, right? So, so if you're only earning $300 a month, it's only $30 in super. So, don't cry me a river, right? It's eminently affordable. And as we know, the whole point of it there is to help the taxpayer longer term, right? We want people to stand on their own feet in retirement and not depend on the public purse. So, it's a great thing. Definitely a great thing.
Mate, my third in the great category was the early childhood education or childcare changes. So for families with two or more kids, the government will now pay 95% of the childcare cost of the second and subsequent child, which I just thought was a really, really smart thing for three reasons. The first is we know that it's good for getting parents, frankly, it's mostly women, let's be honest, call a spade, but whichever parent was otherwise staying at home, not able to return to the workforce, should they want to, and that's important, we're not saying they should have to, but should they want to, often the cost of childcare was a meaningful barrier. If you can have a second child, go into childcare and get back to work, it's good for you. It's great for the economy. Again, we talk about society and the economy. In this case, society first. So the people who want to work hopefully now can, or at least more of them can. Secondly, it's good for the economy because it improves workforce participation. That means more people in the workforce, more people in the economy. That's a positive. Mm. And hopefully, and this I'll have a little bit of a half and half on this one, hopefully great for the kids. I'm a massive proponent. There aren't many programs I would put ahead of early childhood education. If you made me cancel, put red lines through government spending, I would have to cancel dozens and dozens and dozens of programs before I remove money for early childhood education. We know how vital that is across the board, but particularly for kids from disadvantaged areas, low socioeconomic backgrounds, who don't have necessarily the education or the kind of development at home. Giving all kids a great start in life has got to be, for me, one of the very, very, very basic fundamental human rights that we would want in a society like ours, to be a bit of a hippie lefty like you. And I think, I'm glad the money is being spent by the government. I don't love the word childcare because it shouldn't just be babysitting, right? It should be active early childhood education for those kids' benefit. So hopefully most of that will be, but hard to argue with the money being spent. Or can you?
No, I don't argue with that. Where I do take exception with so much in the budget is the term spending or expenditure. Yeah. I would actually see a lot of these things. I think the better term is investment. Yeah. So this costs a lot of money for us taxpayers and the government. Mm-hmm. But it's not just money that we don't get anything back for. We get a more productive society. So, so I've got very strong views on it from a social perspective. I agree with what you said, but I think what's so interesting about so many of these things, this applies to climate change and a whole range and drug policy and a whole range of different things, is like, yes, we're spending a huge amount of money, but what is the return that we get for that? And the return can be just huge over decades and decades and decades. So it's a great thing. One thing that I'm not sure of the detail here, you might be able to help me out. Is that mean tested? See, that's something that I would probably prefer to be in there. I think if you're a power couple and you're earning $500,000 a year, you know, whether the government pays for your childcare or not is not a swing factor. So I would sort of say what you're trying to do here is influence things at the margin. So there's a bunch of people who would love to go back to work but can't because they just can't afford it. Yeah. So for them, that's what they need to sort of to make that transition. For others who are earning squillions, that's not the swing factor. It's basically middle class, upper class welfare, which I'm against. I just don't think Again,
let me challenge you on that one, actually, because I don't massively disagree with your sentiment, but we don't means test public school education, for example, right? And for me, that's why I separate this from childcare. Not why, actually, it's not about the means testing particularly, but it's why I drew a line between childcare / babysitting and early childhood education. If we simply said primary schools start at 3 rather than 5, and those first 2 years are effectively preschool. And the terms actually differ by state, so I'm probably trampling over people's individual understanding. In New South Wales, primary school starts at 5 with kindergarten. There is a less formal preschooling, and there's childhood childcare and babysitting. So for me, I would probably say, and again, I have no problem. I'm not here batting for the high income earners at all. But to me, I would love to think preschool would become part of our formal education system. And for me, that would be the difference. I would say, right, you know what? From 3 or 5, honestly, might I do it from 2, maybe even younger. Having kids have access to really high quality, developmentally appropriate early childhood education should, to me, be part of a social contract we have with each other, which is, you know what? No matter where you come from, what you do, what you earn or what you don't earn, school, in air quotes, starts at 2. And I don't want schools in curriculum. I want schools in preschool, right? But for mine, it's part of that same idea. And that's why I would probably not means test it, just because I think it's broader than that. We don't means test public healthcare the same way. I think it's one of those universal services. But I have no problem with means testing either, for what it's worth.
Yeah, no, that is a fair point. It depends how you want to frame it, is it? I just as a general rule, I think the governments should be and the budget should be there to incentivize the kinds of things that we want. And it's if we're spending money, but it's not changing that incentive structure, then why are we kind of doing it? And for a lot of people, for a lot of programs, it's kind of like we're just giving money to people who would be doing it anyway or wouldn't be doing it anyway. And that it just seems like a poor
investment. No, that's fair. That's totally right. I'm not strongly either way, but to me, it's part of the few things that we do: law and order, health, education. We provide universally. It just strikes me that should be an education component rather than a welfare component or an income support component. But
that's fair. Look, as they say, it's complicated.
Exactly. Let's go to so what I've called the not bad but not obviously great categories. And we won't spend too much time on these, but it's worth having to think about. So the first one for me, I just looked at the second point. You're going to spend a very long time on this. So I'll try not to talk too much. You can talk for a while and we'll see where we get to. First one is the $10 billion being put into aged care is obviously necessary. We know from the Royal Commission that was needed, desperately needed. It will come with rules around the type and amount of nursing care, for example, which is great. The Royal Commission was just uncovered an absolute debacle of an aged care system. And, $10 billion is wonderful. Why I say it's not obviously great is because the Royal Commission wanted $18 billion. I haven't looked into the Royal Commission findings well enough to know what they may have overdone or like everything. If they've gold-plated stuff, maybe you don't need $18 million. But I have to say, given the circumstances, to kind of go, really big issue. We'll fund half of the things you think we need to fund. I'm like, oh, that doesn't quite feel like they've kind of come to the party. Is that reasonable?
Yeah. Again, there's so much nuance in all of this kind of stuff. So we all focus on the headline figures. It seems like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. I mean, it probably should be more money. But but then the more important question is what's around that. There's plenty of situations where throwing more money at things is just it's just throwing bad money after good, and it might not necessarily do anything. There's government spending in a lot of ways can just be very inefficient, and a lot of people can benefit that. Look at what happened with the COVID app, right? So they farmed that out to some of the big IT consulting firms. And as someone who owns an IT business, I just fell off my chair when I heard, not a bit of a segue here, but I do have a point. You know, that thing costs $100 million to build and $200,000 a month to run. It's like, give me a break. Like, there's no way that thing costs that much. So you spent a bunch of money on something that needed to have a bunch of money spent on it, but the return on the investment was awful for something that was wrong. And so my point being is that, yes, I think you're right to sort of say it's overall a good thing. We do need to be spending money here. We just need to make sure that we're spending it in an appropriate way, and that there are appropriate checks and balances around that. So a bunch of organizations and people aren't just sort of, you know, able to skim more off the top. And it sounds cynical, but it happens. You know, we know it happens, right? Like, it's happens again and again and again.
Generally, it really is difficult to try and no matter the area, the circumstance, but not even necessarily money to non-government business or private business, even money within governments. When you've got to start, and this is a hard thing, we talk about the economy and society is different, and they are. When you have to start funding things that don't have easily measurable payoffs, you know, how much money do you give to schools? How much money do you give to research and development? How much money do you, and it's like, research development's a fascinating one. And Anirban, who was on this podcast, between your two appearances, your original and your return, would say we should spend more on it. And conceptually he's right. But I'm like, okay, but someone tell me how much is enough and how much is too much. And not to say he's wrong necessarily, just that question of like, I still don't have a really good framework. Like, if you put two zeros on it, is that enough? Probably not. If you take a zero off, is that too little? Probably. Mm. But where do you kind of, how much do you spend on education? Where, how much do you spend on R&D? How much do you spend on, you know, whatever they are? It's really, really difficult stuff to try and nail down, isn't it?
It's super hard. And it's hard because you spend money today and you hope to get a return many years down the track.
Right, exactly.
And measuring that return is difficult. Yep. And the nature, R&D is a classic example, right? So you don't know until you do the R&D as to whether or not there's any payout.
Right.
And drug companies know this, right? They throw a bunch of money at R&D and then sort of like 1 in 20 might work. And hopefully that makes it. But you don't know until you try. So and then the other complication is the opportunity cost one. So I think all of us would agree that the more we spend on it, that the better the outcomes we've got. But money we spend there, we're not spending elsewhere. And so it's a very tricky balancing act. So
really hard.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's not me, mate, that's got to make the decision just quietly. Like, I just think that sort of stuff. As I, you know, the science minister comes and says we've got to spend twice as much on innovation. Okay. Treasury says we should spend half on innovation. Okay. I don't even know how you even start. Again, conceptually, there's a whole lot of people yelling at the podcast machine now saying, "Of course you should spend more." A whole lot of people saying, "Of course you should spend." Or maybe let's use a really an easier one: the arts. Right. Those people. Yeah. You know, where do you? How much do you spend on the arts? And it's a really, really tough thing to do. And if you literally started, you know, one of the cool things in, or the cool in air quotes, things in corporate America in particular these days is what they call zero-based budgeting. You know, in the old days, you set a company corporate budget by saying, well, we spent $1 million on headcount last year. Let's just increase that by 5%. And our, you know, our stationary cost was this much. Let's increase that by 3% for inflation. And so people create budgets based on last year's spend. Mm-hmm. Zero-based budgets say, start with a blank sheet. Now design your business and tell me how much money you need for each of the things you want to do. And, man, can you imagine trying to zero-base the Australian budget and say how much for art, how much for innovation, how much for R&D, how much for public schools, how much for childcare, how much for, you know, welfare research? Like, I don't know how you would do it. Like, it'd blow my mind trying to get it done.
It's hard. And then there's also the other thing as well, whereas I've sort of said before that we should view it as investment and the return that we get on it. But there are a lot of things where there's a non-monetary investment. So let's say for the sake of argument this is actually probably not far from the truth. There's probably no economic benefit to giving our elderly relatives a high quality of life in their sunset years. Right, I mean, where's the economic payback? Now, there's none. But at the same time, it's just like, well, does that mean that, you know, we feed them dog food and put them in like a dank cardboard box? Well, of course not. There are some things that sort of go beyond that where you sort of say there is absolutely no return on this, but it's the right thing to do. So, again, it's complicated.
It really is. Mate, this is one you're not going to have a view on, I'm sure. We're talking about house prices for a minute. This one was, and I this is why this is in my good but not great, or good but, you know, not great but not terrible section, is basically the government guaranteeing housing deposits for single parents. So the view here is single parents find it hard to get into housing because it's devilishly hard to save the deposit. We all know that. So the government's saying, look, you know what? We will guarantee your deposit. All you need to save is 2% rather than the usual 5 to 10 to 20, depending on which bank and whether you want to pay lenders, mortgage insurance, all that kind of stuff. This is supposed to be a leg up for single parents into the housing market, which I don't think many people can complain about. It seems like a very reasonable, very appropriate thing to do. We know that stability for families, for kids is important, and just for mental health, to back to that society thing, right? Just knowing you've got a roof over your head, being able to put down roots, those things are important ideas that we as a society think are appropriate and desirable. And so giving single parents a chance, a better chance to do that, feels like a really, really good thing. But is this the right way to do it? Well, is it the right thing to do? And is this the right way to do it?
Well, you're right. I'm going to have a long run up on this.
So, oh, I absolutely know that.
You know, so many of these policies are noble in intention, but the impact of it ultimately for a lot of them just tends to drive up house prices. So it doesn't actually solve the affordability.
Let's separate them quickly. Before you're doing it too much, I'm going to step in front of you and stop you run up for a second. Separate those for me. Just because it's important, right?
Yeah.
Is the idea or the concept the right one, or is it the wrong one? And then talk about whether they're doing it the right way.
I think you need to go. I think there's a preposition in this that the only way to get security and all of those good things that you mentioned is to own a home.
Right.
And I would say, we've had this conversation before. I would say, what I would personally do is I think there are huge reforms that are needed to the rental market.
Right.
Like in Europe, people rent for life and it's fine.
Yeah,
and they have all the security and all the advantages that they have. And yeah, you're paying rent every week, but geez, if you're paying a 2% deposit, guaranteed or not, with the other part component of that, in many situations, even with ridiculously low interest rates, I reckon the interest bill you're paying is very comparable to rent anyway. So don't kid yourself that they're necessarily different. So as someone who does rent, you know, and someone who's had 5 houses in 7 years because we continually get kicked out. I've mentioned to you before, it's the biggest mistake I ever made. Yeah, well, it's just like what I didn't factor into my calculations was the security element. And when you're a single mum and you're the people who are struggling, I mean, a home, the value of owning a home is that you do have that security. And I think that is, there's more than one way to solve it. I think we could go a long way by improving the imbalance between landlords and tenants in a way that is fair and equitable and good for all. So I think that's something that's always overlooked. It's part of the Australian psyche that it's all about home ownership. It's a religion in this country, right?
Yep.
And it's for a lot of good reasons, but I just think that we've got to get away from this notion that, you know, renting is bad and that there's, it doesn't have to be. And again, to my initial point on the conversation, we have test tubes from around the world, decades and decades and decades of history where we've seen these models work. So you kind of think, we don't have to guess as to whether this works. We've seen many, many examples in many developed countries, particularly in Europe, where it works phenomenally well. So I'd probably go back a step and say that. And I'd also say this too, so let's say I do scrape together, what's 2% on $1 million, mate? I should be able to do that. It's like 20 grand.
Yep.
So I saved to get 20 grand. I'm still, I'm just going off the average house price in Sydney, which is $1 million, or is it the median? One of those two.
Yeah.
It's still $980,000 debt that I've got there, whether part of that is guaranteed or not, right? Yeah. Now, I've got to pay that back at some stage and I've got to service that as well.
Yeah.
So we saw this in Perth a few years ago as well. A lot of sort of people getting into the housing market for all of the right reasons. It actually ended up being a massive weight around their neck and a huge economic negative for them because it doesn't always go up. And there's a huge burden with servicing these kinds of things. So it's sort of like, yeah, it gets you in, but it's like a pet, you know. A home is for life in a lot of ways. And if you're getting
in
on
for life anyway, yeah, that's right.
Well, the average mortgage is what, 30 years or yeah. something like that. So we're actually saying to people, yeah, we're going to help you get into this situation for very good reasons, but we're also going to make sure we lock you. We're going to put this massive yoke around your neck where you now have this huge debt that you have to service. So it's not as black and white as it seems. I think, and don't get me wrong, I think overall it's a positive move, but I just think it's not as obvious and as clear cut as the government likes to pretend that it is.
I think that's largely true. I'm a little bit more sanguine than you on the home ownership thing, in the sense that I think there's, as I've said many times, I'll probably say a million times again, there's a difference between mathematically the best advice and the right advice for people, and that they can do different things. And I think
so true.
The whole enforced saving thing, I mean, you don't enforce saving in a stupidly overvalued property and have a millstone for years. But I do think there is the maths would say, for example, it's arguably better, maybe not even arguably, to invest in shares rather than own a house and keep paying rent, because the money you generate investing and compounding will more than truly cover your rent relative to a mortgage. So
that was my thinking.
If you do one or the other. Mm. Sorry, mate?
Sorry to interrupt. So that was my thinking. That was the whole basis of my decision to rent. Yeah.
And I think you're an unusual, in a good way, character. For most people, the average person listening to this, or frankly people, I won't name people I know, but people I know, would get to 65, have paid rent, and somehow managed to fritter away the other money they otherwise could have been investing. And so they end up with the worst of both worlds, right? No assets and rent to pay on a pension or something else. And so I do think behavioral finance that we know about, I think for most people, if you can retire with a wholly paid or largely paid off house, the security of not even just the home in and of itself, but the fact that you don't have to pay rent in retirement is its own benefit that I think is probably good for the vast, vast bulk of people. And again, financial advice is always hard, right? The difference between mathematically, rationally, what's absolutely correct versus what should most people just do instead, aren't always the same thing. I say that a lot. I'll keep saying it because it's one of the hallmarks, I think, of good financial advice, right? Is, you know, what should I do is not what mathematically would make the most sense. They're very different things.
I 100% agree. It only makes sense if you take the capital that you otherwise would have spent on a property, invested that with a lot of discipline, with a lot of endurance over many, many years.
Yeah.
Makes actually a huge amount of sense. It's a ridiculous amount of sense. But if you don't, then it's all for naught.
Correct.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's move on to the next one, mate, and we'll try and keep this quick. This one is interesting. I think I like it, but I'd be persuaded either way. This was the extension of the instant tax write-off for businesses less than $5 billion in turnover. So basically, the idea is, and we won't get a tax law too detailed here. Effectively, if you bought a car in the old days, because I'm old, you could claim, I don't know what the numbers are, let's say it was a 5-year useful life. You could depreciate a fifth of that, 20% of that every year, and then claim it on tax. So if I bought it, I'm going to make my maths really easy, mate, because it makes my life easier. If I bought a $50,000 car, I could claim $10,000 of that on tax over the following 5 years. Because the argument goes, it's an ongoing asset, it's a useful asset. So, you know, it depreciates, it eventually is worth nothing, but you get to claim the depreciation as the expense, not the actual upfront purchase. And that makes mathematical, accounting, logical sense. A couple of years ago, the government ratcheted this up, was 25 grand, that was 50 grand. I think it was 150 grand or something this year. Basically, now it's like any asset. Anything you buy, if you're doing under $5 billion of turnover, you can basically claim it on tax straight away. Now, here's where I'm a bit torn. Firstly, it doesn't really hurt the budget because it just brings the tax deduction forward. So instead of 10 grand over 5 years, it's 50 grand now, then nothing over the next 4 years. So it's kind of the same thing. I mean, interest is zero, but there's a slight timing cost, I suppose, if you want to look at it that way. But realistically, so, you know, no real budget impact. Does it incentivize businesses to buy stuff they wouldn't have otherwise needed? Yeah, that's probably bad. Plenty of tradies with new Hiluxes who probably should have got a couple of years out of the old one just for purely financial reasons. Does it help businesses who get that business? Yes. It also, though, kind of makes, and this can never go away, right? Because the second you announce it goes away, everyone goes and buys everything for June 30th and no one buys anything for 3 months. And so all those car sellers and stationary office furniture, they're going to do no business for 3 or 4 straight months.
It's a sugar hit.
Bought it, right? Right. And you can't take the sugar away. I'm really torn. I get the value. I don't know that for small businesses, depreciating that stuff really makes any sense anyway, because small businesses run on cash. They don't run on accrual accounting. So I kind of think it's a net positive, but in saying that, kind of has to be here forever now. How do you feel about it? Am I right? Am I wrong? Am I missing the point?
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of that. I mean, I'll just put my hand up and say I don't have the expertise, or have not thought deeply enough about it to have a really informed view. I do err to your comment, though, where I think for a lot of small businesses, you know, if you're doing it super tough, and this is, it might not be enough of a swing factor. It'll definitely help. Yeah. I was listening to the radio last night on the way to dropping the kids somewhere, and there was someone from a small business lobby group saying, actually, it's not that great, which I thought was really interesting. So, I don't have a strong view on that one.
Interesting. I like it, mate. Yep. Last one for me in this area is the tax break for innovation. Now, I talked about innovation before in R&D. I didn't actually do that deliberately. I should have kept that thought till now. The government's saying if you're in, I think it's just biotech, but generally speaking, if you've got a patent and you make some money from that, when you make the profit from that new innovation, new invention, the new patent, we're going to tax you at 17% rather than the 25% corporate tax rate for small and medium businesses and 30% for big businesses. And the idea is to kind of reward innovation. I think this is okay. It's fine. But when people give tax breaks for this sort of stuff, it kind of blows my mind, right? So if I'm a business and I invent a new patent and it goes nowhere, I lose all that money and I get no benefit. Mm-hmm. If I invent a new patent and it goes spectacularly well, I make $100 million in profit, okay, mm-hmm. I pay you know, $17 million in tax rather than $25 million in tax. That matters. Mm. But I'm still left with more than $75 million under any of those scenarios, in which case,
yes.
Where's the incentive? It feels to me like it's a bit of a...
Same.
Either it's going to create no new activity, or it's just basically a free hit for those businesses in that sector who are going to do it anyway. And like, well, we're going to do it anyway because I made a lot of money, and sure, pay less tax. Okay, fine, if you want to. But it wasn't like we weren't going to do it because we didn't want the $75 million after tax. They're going to do it because it's profitable either way, aren't they?
Yep, 110% agree with that. It's all about the incentive. People, what problem are we trying to fix here? There's not enough biotech companies out there investing. There's plenty of them, and maybe it does help a little bit, but I don't think anyone in this space is a swing factor. And you know, this whole idea, it's like with other things too, where we get into this race to the bottom with different states trying to offer lower corporate tax rates to attract people, and like. It is the best, I've often said this, is the best problem in the world is having a huge tax bill. I'm so frustrated hearing people complain about it. The only way you pay a lot of tax is by earning a lot of money, you know? So it's kind of like, here's your choice. Don't make much and you don't have to pay much tax, or make a squillion and pay a lot of tax. I'll make a squillion, thanks, and pay net after everything is said and done. I'm always better off. Now, there's a big spectrum there, and you can move the dial along that. So that's a more nuanced debate. But I 100% agree with your point.
Yeah, nice. All right. The last one, or let's listen to the next. We'll try and make this a bit quicker, mate. So a couple of stuff I don't think is awesome. I am on record as being a believer in the science of climate change, and there was a little bit of kind of sprinkling money so they could say we're doing something, but nothing really meaningful and fundamental there. University funding is falling, and again, if we want to be a smart, innovative nation, giving tax breaks but they're not putting in place in university makes no sense to me.
No.
There was some money being thrown around for tax on microbreweries and some job support for the video gaming industry, which I kind of thought, even if you could justify the actual spending to pick those two industries out, was just kind of weird and unnecessary. And it's like, didn't we finish picking winners when we stopped subsidizing the car industry? That struck me kind of just a little bit bizarre. Your thoughts on any or all of those?
I think the government had missed an incredible opportunity in terms of the investment they could have made with clean energy. They had a blank check from the population. When COVID hit and it was just like, we need money, we need it now, we need stimulus. And the government, to their credit, threw a bunch of money at it. Mm-hmm. They could have thrown a lot of it at the renewable sector. And so still achieved the same result with huge stimulus, but also did all this nation building kind of stuff. And I know, because you had to preface it there, it's like, you feel these days you kind of have to say, oh, look, yeah, I do believe in it, but I don't want to have a bit of an argument. Screw that, my friend. I'm happy to sort of come out here and say I'm unashamedly doing it. Because, look, you get to a point where it's sort of like you can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts. And we're at a point, what am I talking about? We've been at a point for decades now where it's just sort of like, it's just, if I was about to get onto a plane and 99 engineers came up to me and said, I would not get on that plane. We've checked it. It's, you know, it doesn't look good. And then one guy says, no, I think it's fine. Yeah, no, it's fine. Get onto it. You know, are you going to get on that plane? And that's the exact situation with it. So I put that to one side. And if I've upset anyone there, well, I'm not actually that sorry. But then I would actually separate. I think we're at the point now where we can actually separate that out of it. So, and let's just look at it from hardcore economic sort of perspective. So it's just cheaper now, right? It's like with the housing conversation I had before with renting. Let's go back a step. What do we really want here? Well, we want reliable, cheap energy, and I think we want a cleaner environment. You know, I think everyone can agree on that. So then it's a question of saying, well, objectively, what's going to deliver that to us? And this isn't 1987 where, you know, the costs of these technologies are, you know, where they're unproven. We know that they work incredibly, incredibly well. So why not do it? And I'd bet my left arm on it that it's too ideologically driven. It's like that train wreck of an interview on Sky. I don't know if you saw during the week with that minister. He just basically refused to acknowledge that battery could back up a wind farm. You know, it's just like, even if you're against it, you just would not do.
We know the audio capabilities to include that in the podcast, and some people will be coalition supporters and voters who won't appreciate me making fun of it. But I swear to God, that is Clark and Dawes Central. Just look up Keith Pitt, Sky News. It was
embarrassing.
It was farcical, mate. And it was one of those... Honestly, it reminded me of the skit The Front Fell Off by Clark and Dawe?
Yes,
it was one of those. It was...
Satire.
I'm always impressed with how well Keith Pitt manages to avoid answering the question. Like, there's a small amount of me which is like, I'm actually impressed that given you decide to avoid answering the question, you managed to avoid it in four different ways. Satire is dead. That's why I tweeted, actually. Satire is dead. It is absolutely bizarre. Anyway.
So look, again, I just think, you know, let's stop having the conversation of whether it's true or not with climate change. By the way, it's true. But let's stop having that conversation and let's just look at it like hardcore capitalists. And if you look at it like hardcore far-right capitalists, you have to conclude that this is a cheaper, better, safer technology. And so let's do it, right? it's crazy.
Very funny, very funny. All right. So last one, mate, then we'll wrap this budget chat up. And this is the big one, the $1.2 trillion problem or issue or whatever you want to call it. Is the amount of government debt we are going to have at the end of what the budget likes to call the forward estimates, which I love the budget jargon, I'm such a nerd. The end of the forward estimates, $1.2, I think, trillion dollars in debt. No plan to pay it off, no plan to reduce it, no plan to pay it down, no plan to deal with it whatsoever. And I should say, we're recording this on Thursday as we always do. I don't think it'll happen, but we should be able to expect both the government and the opposition have a plan. Can enunciate a plan for getting that debt back to some sort of normalcy. This can't be the new normal, surely. I know people don't, there's people out there who will yell at me when I say this because it's the old, you know, government budget isn't a household budget. I know. I get it, people. So back the heck off. We had a great holiday last year. It wasn't a great holiday. We dug ourselves out of a hole. But effectively, we spent some money on the old corporate, you know, country credit card to get ourselves out of a hole. And then we're like, you know what? Let's pay that off slowly over some multiple decades, including leaving it for the kids. And I just, for the life of me, mate, I cannot stomach the concept of, debt doesn't matter, or, well, we don't need to pay it back, or let's just wait for growth to inflate it away. Like, we literally borrowed from the future to dig ourselves out of a hole. And we did, and great. So we did exactly the right thing to do, had the right effect. But you know what? if I borrow a tenner to get home because I've lost my wallet on the train, I pay you back the next day. I don't say, man, look, what I'm going to do is, I know I was in a bit of a spot, and I really appreciate you lending me the money, and it was the right thing for me to borrow it from you, but I'm going to pay, actually, I'm not going to pay you back. I'm just going to let my son know that when I'm gone, he can pay some of that money back. Is that all right with you? I mean, it boggles my mind that neither of them are going to man up, if I can use the gendered phrase, and actually bloody set a plan, don't have to pay it back today, but set a plan for actually paying back the largesse that we used.
Well, you know what? Paying it back is going to be harder if we keep giving all these tax cuts away, I would say.
That's the problem, right? There is no plan. The budget is structurally imbalanced and getting worse.
Yeah. Well, look,
it drives me nuts.
This is where it's easy to be cynical, and I put my hand up. I probably am at the point of peak cynicism at this point, but I mean, it's an election budget, right? You know, who doesn't love a tax cut and all the rest of it, this kind of stuff? But it's just sort of like if we need to pay for certain things, whether that's aged care or education or innovation or all of these things that we all agree is good, well, it needs to come from somewhere, right? And so you need to think of that. The other thing I'd say in terms of debt is that this is a really nuanced and a very difficult conversation. And interestingly enough, you can go to the global economic experts, and they don't seem to have a good handle on this either. Is just how much debt is too much? It's a really tricky question. It's more about. It's a good John Oliver on this actually, the other week. He's talking about the US deficit and budget, but it's more about what the debt is used for. So I'll give you another example. So you've given the one of borrowing a tenner to get home in a taxi. What if I could borrow, and I'm borrowing, if I'm the government, I'm borrowing money virtually for free for the next 30 years.
Close enough,
It's not so much about the debt, but it's the return I get. And that if you will lend me $100 and say, I'll lend that to you at 2%, and I'm super confident that I can get a 10% return on that, I should borrow as much as I can. Right, like it's going to be very, very beneficial to me. And if I'm also using that money not only to generate a return for myself, but to add some really important things to make our society better, then there is an argument to be said for that. So if you're going to borrow a bunch of money and then go and play the pokies, well, that's different. Yeah, so I just want to make the point that yes, you're right. At a point, it's crazy. A lot of in history, you can reach a point where it becomes crippling and it's bad for everyone. But it's at the same time, interest rates are super low. The government can borrow money really effectively. There's a whole bunch of areas that we need to spend money on that we will get really good returns on, whether that's direct economic returns or just societal returns. For me, it's more about how we're spending that money, and also too, just being a bit careful that we aren't structurally hobbling ourselves so it just becomes impossible to pay it back.
That's my issue is twofold, mate. I don't disagree with anything you just said, with the exception that, and I actually also accept no one has a perfect answer for this, but we had a level of debt before and we've got a much higher level of debt now. At some point, maybe that point is a billion, trillion, gazillion dollars, right? But at some point, people aren't going to lend us any more money, or we're going to have to pay a lot for it, or we're going to default on it and cause a whole lot of massive dramas. And I think for me that if someone wants to convince me that $1 trillion is fine, then okay. But is $2 trillion fine? Is $5 trillion fine? Because at some point we're going to have another crisis and we're going to need the government to put their hands in their pockets for more money. And unless you take a view, and I guess you could, I don't, but you could take a view that the matter never, ever, ever matters, no matter what, no matter how big it is. If you take that view, then you really don't care. But most of the commentary I'm saying is, oh, a bit more borrowing is fine. Yeah, sure. I'm like, okay, I will accept that line if you tell me how much would be too much. Or at least accept that there is a level which some amount is too much. Because if we're going to keep borrowing, I mean, this is what gets me right. The whole idea breaks down at some point. If governments around the world just keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, and effectively, at worst, that just creates massive inflation because they're just creating more money and borrowing from more people. It's got to be paid back. Speaking of Clark and Dawes, some great Clark and Dawes stuff on some of the GFC stuff about money not being paid back. It's just spectacular. Yeah. But if you can take revenue of 100, borrow 110 over and over and over and over again, and the numbers getting bigger and no one cares. I mean, at some point it's just a Ponzi, isn't it? I don't know how there is not a maximum somewhere that someone says, okay, that's probably too much, but we're miles away from that, or we're close to that, or halfway to that, or whatever. Otherwise, the whole thing breaks down, doesn't it?
Well, I'm really trying to restrain myself here because there's a rabbit hole in front of me that's very tempting to go down.
Stay away.
But briefly, there is a... Well, it's actually not that new, but it's having a bit of a resurgence amongst some very serious people, this idea of modern monetary theory, which actually says exactly that. It doesn't matter. You know, so the one thing where governments are different is that governments can create money. They can invent it. They can turn the printing presses on, and that's actually fine according to this theory, so long as, and you've already mentioned it, so long as inflation doesn't get out of control. Correct. So that's probably the more important
thing. But also don't forget, they argue that taxes can be used to do the same thing as debt. Like I think they kind of turn the whole thing 90 degrees, but the same constraints actually apply, which is you can pretend that interests matter or don't, or taxes matter or don't, or debt matters or doesn't, but the whole thing is still the same size balloon, right? Like you blow it at a certain point. If inflation gets out of control, then that is the problem. How do you fix it then? Well, I think the concept works while it works, but I don't see the out of bounds of MMT having a solution for. We'll just hope it doesn't happen, or we'll make sure it doesn't happen. It's like no, but when it does, it's not going to happen. Yeah, no, we know. But in the real world, when it does happen, what are you going to do about it? That's the bit I don't. It's one of those theories, a bit like that we started with the theories of trickle down. It's like nice idea, but what happens when it doesn't actually come to pass? Well, no, it will, because it's right. Yeah, but what if it does? Yeah, that's the... I don't see that being answered anyway.
The short answer is I don't know. And every time I've tried to read up on it or even watch YouTube videos on it or, whatever, I find that it's one of these areas that's super complicated and you can have some of the brightest, best respected economists in the world argue one point of view, you and I, and then you've got others that will argue a different point of view and they're both good arguments. And so I actually haven't reached a conclusion on it. So I'm actually desperate for someone to sort of lay it out for me in a way that I can wrap my little brain around, because I instinctively I think you're right that there's definitely a point. I just have no idea at what point that becomes a serious problem and what we might forego in the meantime. I don't know. But
without going down too far down the MMT rabbit hole, because you're right, we've done that already, but the other thing they don't deal with is international trade, have you noticed? So in a closed economy, I think MMT works in a closed economy. In a completely closed economy with a single currency, it makes perfect sense. But what it doesn't allow for is the effect of your internal systems and balances and checks and settings and whatever. So I'm talking about interest rates, inflation, economic growth, all that sort of stuff on your exchange rate. When, for Australia, for example, if the settings were internally fine but destroyed the exchange rate in either direction, it destroys our exports or our imports. I've not seen anyone describe that, because the idea, as you say, of like closed economy, governments create their own money, so it doesn't really matter. It's like, yeah, but if someone's creating a lot of money in that country but no money in that country, the difference is there. Like I haven't yet seen anyone well explain the international trade implications, the other problem I have with MMT.
It's a bit like communism in the sense that it's actually...
Do you know what I mean?
Like it kind of... Communism's actually a really great... I'm going to out myself as a commie. I'm not a commie. It's one of those things that in theory, perfectly executed, is probably great and probably better. Yeah. But it's just not likely to be. So it's just, Yeah, it's complicated. Right. I shouldn't have brought MMT up, but to finish it, put a line under this. I think you're right. It should not be laissez-faire. We should not just spend like there's no tomorrow and not worry about the debt.
Yeah, right.
At the same time, I'm more comfortable with it if we're getting good returns on the money that we are borrowing.
There you go. Let's use that as a segue, because I want to talk very briefly about one of the lines in the budget, but also the impact it's having on some companies in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
The iron ore price. I'm sure I must have ever ranted about the margins of iron ore here on this podcast. I'm sure I have. You would know if I have. Are you nodding at me or not? You're smiling like I'm trying to...
I'm smiling because I know what you're going to say, because I just know you so well, but whether or not you've mentioned it on the podcast, I'm not sure.
So the iron ore price is currently $200-something a tonne. Mm-hmm. The cost of getting out of the ground is less than $20 a tonne. That is 90% gross margins for iron ore. They are better than software margins, where software is supposed to be the best business model ever invented, bar none. And these guys have been digging stuff out of the ground for decades and centuries, have actually beaten software at their own game on margins, which for some people is like, well, hey, how good is this? for the rest of us who actually know a bit of economic history, it's like, oh, that's going to end badly. And I think that's so what I was really pleased about, mate, so one of the good things from the budget, which is very dry but still good, Treasury have assumed that the iron ore price falls from $200 a ton back to $55 a ton next year.
Yep.
That's and I think that is super, super smart, conservative and thoughtful, because if it doesn't happen, hey, if we get 60, 80, 100, great, we've got some more money than we thought we'd get.
Yep.
If it does happen, then thank God they didn't bloody set a budget expectations on the current level of iron ore price. It is just economically impossible for over the long run, unless you control literally the world supply of something and you can't, no others can be invented or found, no other substitutes can be invented or found, no alternative options, processes, source materials can be found. Eventually, when someone finds more iron ore and starts supplying it, the price is going to come back to the marginal cost of production roughly. So that's 30, 40, 50 bucks a ton, right? Mm-hmm. So I was really, really excited to see that Treasury do that. I will say the iron ore share price are flying. The BHP share price, I think, hit a record. Rio is pretty high. Fortescue is doing fantastically well. So we'd mentioned before the podcast, I don't know if you have a separate point to make, but I just, in this case, A, great, wonderful, good for the budget, good for royalties, good for iron ore company shareholders. Please be careful. If your view is, hey, this will go on forever, I just invite you to have a look at the old supply-demand curve from Year 8 Economics or Commerce and ask yourself why you think the economy, no further supply will come on stream to push that iron ore price down. Just remarkably unlikely, I think.
Yep. No, I will bet my left arm and yours on the fact that will happen. The timing of that, who can say? Look, there's some problems with the other major global suppliers of iron ore. China continues to want to hoover it up. We've got the best stuff on the planet. It's going to be great for a time. It really is. And these companies should be making hay while the sun shines. It's fantastic. I just caution it from an investment point of view is, one of the dangerous things with investing is extrapolation, and we just sort of we extrapolate out into the future forever. Yep. And you know the theory would tell you that the value of a company is the sum of all its future cash flows. Mm-hmm. At some point in the future, the cash flows won't be as strong. it's just be careful, and we see it happening. And it, by the way, it happens on the other side, right? Of the cycle as well. When the price is really low, a lot of marginal producers go out of business, people aren't investing in new production, and all of a sudden there's not enough supply to go around, and guess what happens? The price shoots back up and then everyone gets back in. So we have this sort of stabilizing mechanism that's sort of implicit in the whole system. So it is great for Australia. Long may the price stay high. Fantastic. Right. Good stuff. It won't stay that way.
Don't bet on it, hey.
Don't bet on it.
Speaking of staying high, the other, the recovery from COVID has been spectacularly good, right? We all know that. And look, fantastic, really excited about it. Bank shareholders are going to do very, very well out of all this. The bank share price, the bank profits have roared back. Commonwealth Bank this week announced $2.4 billion in profit, not for a year, not for a half, for a quarter. $2.4 billion for a quarter. Now, my maths is not great, but I'm taking that's about $9.6 billion for a year if you annualize that. Mm-hmm. They've also announced that because they had to cut the dividend last year, they've got $10 billion of surplus capital that's looking to come back to shareholders. Has there ever been a better time to be a bank shareholder?
Yeah, I'd like to be a bank shareholder in the mid-90s.
It was we were younger and better looking and funnier and fitter and stuff?
Well, I would very much like to go back for all of those reasons. But it was the start of a very strong era for the banks for a whole bunch of competitive reasons which we've gone into before. I think if you're a shareholder, I think it is good news. What they do with that money is going to be the difficult thing. The theory is, I think we mentioned this last week, is that you should pay out every single cent that you've got no good use for. If Commonwealth Bank can keep all that money and reinvest that and spit out a 15% return, then they shouldn't pay any dividend whatsoever. Yeah. That's what Buffett does, right? Because he gets these incredible returns. If they can't, they should keep everything they can to sustain their operations and grow where is prudent. But if they can't, they should return it to shareholders. But then you've got that too, and this is a big lead up into what you're saying with the buybacks. There's two options there. We can pay you cash or we can buy back shares. And that is a return to you in a roundabout kind of way. because it reduces the number of shares or the number of slices that the pizza is cut into. So your proportional ownership increases, and therefore your per share earnings and per share dividends all increase. So it's a good thing. If, and here's the big if with buybacks, it only makes sense if the shares are below what you might consider fair value. So if shares are super, super expensive, then a buyback is absolutely just setting money on shareholder money on fire.
Right.
And you should pay the cash. so that's really the nub of the question here is like, okay, the coffers are full, lots of cash, that's great. Should they be buying back shares? I think we've both been on the record as saying banks aren't phenomenal value at this point in time.
Correct.
So I would prefer a dividend.
Yeah. It's a challenge though, right? I mean, to some degree, do you pay no tax on a buyback if you don't sell your shares into the buyback? So your proportional ownership increases without the tax being paid. And I've got to say, so there's two questions, as you say. What should the company do, and then what should the shareholders prefer? And they're kind of different because what the company does, the third option, as you say, is investing for growth. We don't have the option as shareholders. We can either receive a buyback benefit or dividend benefit. It would be interesting. So the other thing about bank shares, of course, is that most shareholders are there for the dividends. And so there'll be a whole lot of people, you know, banging on the door saying, give us more cash because we want the actual cash to go and, you know, pay the bills. And, you know, most people are doing it in retirement, near retirement. So that's kind of, there's that. Even if the buyback does increase the proportional ownership, I mean, you know, Apple's bought back something like 10 or 15% of its stock over time. Berkshire's even doing it. You mentioned Warren Buffett owns shares in Berkshire. You mentioned that. It's a huge question for investors. And also, you know, to some degree, if they do a buyback, you're effectively, you're doing the equivalent of them giving you a dividend and then you're using it to buy more Commonwealth Bank shares.
Same thing. And so the question is,
I mean, actually, there's no transaction, but effectively that's what you're doing because you're increasing your ownership in that company by other people's shares being taken off market. But it's kind of the same thing in a roundabout kind of way, which
conceptually
also begs the question, if you weren't going to buy, if you don't think they're the best shares to buy, even if you think Commonwealth Bank, you know, you want your proportional ownership increased because you don't want to pay the tax, if I gave you $1,000, which share do you want to buy? Unless your answer is the company buying back its shares, you should actually want the dividend so you can actually go and put your money into something else, right? Rather than just a higher proportional ownership in the company just because you happen to own it. If it's your 20th best idea, a buyback is not, even if shares are below intrinsic value or around intrinsic value, it's still they're making the decision on your behalf rather than you saying, I'll have the cash, thank you very much, and decide what to do with it, even if you are paying a little bit in tax on the way through.
Yeah, yep, I agree with all of that. Nothing to add, as Charlie Munger would say.
I have nothing to add, exactly. Mate, we've gone very long. I hope the budget conversation was interesting for you and for our listeners. Breaking it down a little bit, look, it was partly about the budget, but I think it gave us an opportunity to talk about the economy in a different way. And I hope that's what most of our listeners have taken from this, is the swing factors of the economy, where money is better or worse spent. You're right, I claim no expertise or infallibility. I mean, I am infallible, but I don't claim that. But it's important because, you know, hopefully it gave us a sense of run through the economy, what's moving, what's not, how the money can be spent. We will come back on Sunday, mate, and I reckon we probably should do a mailbag. What do you reckon?
I think we definitely should.
There you go, we will. I should give a quick mention too. I'm going to start the mailbag episode, mate, with a non-mailbag question.
Okay.
As we speak, the ASX is down again. Volatility has been really present, particularly with some larger, some better known, some higher growth stocks. It's been a tough old run generally over the last 3 months. But this week in particular, US inflation is up, interest rate talk is up, and it's having an impact on share prices. So my first question to you on Sunday, get ready for this one, is going to be, here's a bit of a tease for our listeners as well, we're seeing the rubber hit the road, as I mentioned. This is real economy stuff. This is inflation rearing its head and potentially having impacts on the market. So we will discuss that as our first question on Sunday, and then we'll get into our listeners' mailbag questions because that's probably more important than what I think is important. But hopefully the inflation and the volatility questions are worth talking about because it's going to be in the news. It's going to be all over the place. As I said, the US market fell more than 2% Wednesday night our time. A lot is happening. And it's probably worth considering. So there you go. Bit of a tease for Sunday. In advance of that, make sure you do subscribe to the Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes, your favorite Android podcast app, or the Listener app. You don't want to miss this Sunday's podcast or any of them, of course, by definition. So make sure you do subscribe. Please do leave us a rating and a review if you would be so kind. We really do appreciate it. I mention it almost every week. It genuinely does help our podcast get found by more people, and that's important for us. Hopefully it's important for you and important for them. If we're adding some value, hopefully that's useful. And of course, don't forget you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox with some marketing from us by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Now, if you want to follow Andrew, and you should, you can simply go to strawman.com. That's where his business is based. That's where his business is. That is his business. Go to strawman.com or jump onto the socials. Exactly. Jump onto the socials at @Sage_Simeon is his Twitter handle, or at @StrawmanInvest. That's Andrew's two Twitter accounts. If you want to get in touch with me, at @TMFScottP or at @TheMotleyFoolAU, that's both for Twitter and Instagram. Or if you're on Facebook, The Motley Fool Australia or Scott Phillips Money. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Thanks for listening.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.